Hello and welcome to Monocle on Culture. I'm Robert Bound, and we're often all cooped up in January anyway, and this year even more so than usual. So on the programme today, we're rounding up some TV and musical goodies for you to indulge in over the next month or two. Join me on the show to give me the lowdown on some of the best things old and new to hit the small screen in the near future. It's the TV critic and broadcaster Scott Bryan, and here to spin some of January's finest records is music journalist, DJ and broadcaster Georgie Rogers. Welcome both to the programme. Lovely to have you. Nice to Zoom with you this afternoon.
Hi.
Hello.
You're both looking wonderful. Scott, we've got to get in here. You've got a wealth of stuff to talk about today. We're starting in the icy waste, not necessarily in the icy waste, but in the chilly north of Sweden. And this is the investigation.
Yeah, so it is an interesting one for many reasons. It's a six-part series from Denmark that looks at the murder of Swedish journalist Kim Wall in 2017. Kim Wall was a Swedish freelance journalist. She had written for The Guardian, The New York Times, Vice, Time and Slate. And in 2017, in August, she had plans to move to Beijing. But then she received a text to meet a Danish entrepreneur, Peter Madsen, and interview him on a submarine. But the submarine never returned to harbour, and she was then reported missing. And this drama that's over six episodes, which is airing on HBO Go in the US, but also on the BBC Two in the UK, looks at the investigation. And I think it's interesting for a few reasons. I think the first thing is that Kim Wall's parents are involved in this, that they've given it their consent. I think the second part is that it doesn't really look at the person who committed the crime. It more looks at the difficulty in trying to find out what happened. With the expanse of the ocean, with the unique circumstances she went missing, with a lot of media intrigue that happened at the time, it looks purely at the authorities' perspective. But I think another interesting thing is that I think it shows the rise of dramas that aren't in the English language being popular on English TV channels. For a long time now in the UK, we've had BBC Four playing a lot of Scandinoir dramas, phenomenal pieces of work. But I think people have normally sort of pigeonholed them, thinking, oh, you know, this is just a show that we'll put on Saturdays that's a bit grisly. And I think the fact that it's now on BBC Two is not just because we've run out of dramas being made because of the pandemic. I think it's because the standards of them are now so high. People don't mind watching a drama with subtitles for an entire hour. And it's the same in the US as well. It's got the backing of HBO. It's going on HBO Go, which is their streaming service. And I think it shows how far this sort of genre of TV has come in only a very few years.
It sounds amazing. And the trailer is lean and mean and moody, and it opens with this sort of homemade submarine being boarded, right? I mean, there's a spookiness to it. Can you tell us a little bit about the cast in this?
I mean, I think it's got a great cast of people who you would recognise from so many different shows. I think mostly from Borgen, which was the really successful series. It's now actually been so successful, it's coming back for a fourth season on Netflix. You can watch the first three on there. So Soren Marling, Pilo Asbeck are two of the casts that have been attached to it. But I think that there is a need at the moment. Drama has always been used as a way to explain journalism and has been there to explain stories. It has been for many years, of course. But I think in recent years, there's been a real focus on trying to make them as authentic as possible. That people really love the minutiae of looking through investigations and trying to work out the pieces of the puzzle. That people love something that is forensic and detailed. But also, you don't have to resort to grisliness. It can be moody, it can be depressing, it can be a sad story overall, but you don't have to make it therefore gratuitous or focusing a lot on the victim per se. You can focus on what it really means and what the implications are for the victim's families rather than just purely focusing on the victim.
Yeah, it looks like a classy piece of work, the investigation, Scott. Also, before we move on to your next choice, I love your idea that, oh, it's a bit grisly, we'll put it on a Saturday night. Saturday nights around Brian mansions sound good. Who knew they were so grisly, Scott? What are you doing?
What I love is always at this time of year, you know, when it's so dark and depressing, and it's the same case with all broadcasters, they go, oh, you know, everyone needs a bit of a cheer up. Let's now go for the most depressing show we can physically think of. Like between Christmas and New Year, you know, the bit where you don't know what day it is, that's when BBC in the UK decides to put on the darkest Agatha Christie adaptation where everyone has a horrible time as physically possible. It's part of our DNA. It's not just me.
Also, at the moment, it's like no one really knows, you know, a Saturday feels like a Tuesday and a Monday feels like a Wednesday. It's like all so confused. But I just spent the weekend watching The Serpent, which is very dark.
So good.
So good.
Yeah. So quickly on The Serpent, I've been humming and hawing about whether to get invested in The Serpent. That's on the iPlayer, the BBC iPlayer, I guess we should say, tell listeners. I just like the fact that it was sort of set in Thailand and looked quite kind of tropical and sexy. But yeah. Am I missing a trick, or is it a grisly Saturday around Scott Bryan's house?
So I feel with that one, what's really smart about it is that it deliberately tries to make it look like it's a flashy Bond-style thriller. Mm. But it's about a con man who manipulated people and then unfortunately many people died under his trust. And what the drama does so well is that it peels back the layers of this guy who from the outside looked cool and sexy and really interesting, but actually was a cold-hearted killer. And I like the fact that you get lured in. So the first 2 hours, I think you have to stick with it. It takes a lot. There's a lot of toing and froing back and forth. But by the third hour, I think you really start to get to the heart about what with this awful manipulator and what a terrible individual this person was.
Okay, so that's The Serpent, as recommended by Georgie Rogers and The Investigation. Thank you, Scott. And that is on BBC Two, if you're in the UK, and premieres on February the 1st on HBO. Scott, your next choice is on Netflix. Now, this has been... I've seen some bits and bobs of this, a lot of chat online about this. We're going to play the trailer for Fran Lebowitz and Martin Scorsese's Pretend It's a City.
In New York, there are millions of people, and the only person looking where she's going is me. I should write a manifesto, the title of which would be Pretend It's a City. It would take one subway ride for the Dalai Lama to turn into a lunatic, raging person. I'm the only person who's lived in New York as long as I have who has never made a correct real estate decision. Do people buy books here?
At this kiosk, no.
Do you think it's fair to bring a book into Times Square? It's not fair to the books. People want to challenge themselves. I find real life challenging enough.
Does complaining change anything?
Not so far. I mean, of course, I'm a young woman.
You heard there Fran Lebowitz talking to Martin Scorsese and others in Pretend It's a City, new to Netflix. Scott, this looks like a charming thing. We all kind of miss the busyness of cities. This is kind of a bit of a thought about that.
It is, and it's a coincidental one too, because I think that when they made this, I mean, it's her describing her love for New York, but also a lot of the time she just moans about cities, to be honest. She really sort of tears New York apart, the frustrations, the tourists, the fact that people aren't looking where they're going because they're constantly peering through their phone, hence the whole purpose of the title, Pretend It's a City, realise that there's other people living in the city than just you. But of course, this is now debuting at the time when, you know, pretty much every city is completely hollowed out, that everyone's staying at home, but also people aren't commuting into cities. And of course, there's practically no late night entertainment at all. So this has a deeper resonance because it reminds you, for those people who really are missing the cities that they are living in right now, that things will return to normal, but will also remind them about, you know, what makes a city a city. And there's a great quote, I think it's in the second episode, when the interviewer says, why are so many people coming to New York? And she simply responds with, and she's so deadpan, I love how deadpan she is, she just responds, it's New York, what's not here? It sums up. And she also so talks brilliantly about how, you know, she had a friend complaining to her about New York being expensive. And it's like, of course, New York's expensive. Yet 8 million people live here. How? I don't know. But that's how it is.
Yeah, it is refreshing. This show is refreshingly urban, I suppose. And Fran Lebowitz has been such a great sort of interlocutor on the idea of cities, a great writer, raconteur. and, you know, kind of Vanity Fair magazine sort of stalwart as well. It's what's the interplay like, Scott, between Fran Lebowitz and the director and producer of this series, Martin Scorsese, two kind of legends of New York City, right?
Yeah, I mean, you get to see it, you know, it's shot in a very certain way. It's glossy. It consists of essentially her as if she's running a press conference. So there's many people in front of her asking her questions. But then you also have intimate shots where it's just literally them two having a chat. And then Martin's there, you know, half the time he's asking the questions, but he's not overbearing it or trying to do it. I think Fran is very much the heart of the piece. And I think it's also... It, you know, it is interesting at the moment in which, you know, the highest A grade of talent are making TV series and are being in charge of it. And sometimes they can feel like they're just prestige projects or just for their own amusement. And you can tell that Martin's having the time of his life making it. But it is actually an enjoyable piece of work. The fact that it's done by Martin Scorsese is a great thing, but it doesn't necessarily get in the way of it. Per se, it just makes me wonder about now we're going to have so many different types of shows. If I'm not expecting a Hollywood A-list director, I'm going to be like, oh, is it even a show?
Yeah.
Is it even a show?
Coming soon, The News, directed by Francis Ford Coppola. Maybe that's what we've exactly what we've got, actually. That's what feels like we're living in The Godfather. That is Pretend It's a City. It's on Netflix right now. And it's directed by Martin Scorsese. Who else? Who else are you going to get to direct a documentary about New York City starring Fran Lebowitz? Also, new to the BBC, I think every journalist that takes himself slightly too seriously can remember where he was when The Power of Nightmares first came out on the TV. And Adam Curtis, the creator of that show, has something new on. Tell us quickly about this one, Scott.
So it's a bit vague, as you would expect, in terms of trying to build expectation and sort of making you very compelled to watch it when it's out. So it's called Can't Get You Out of My Head, which is not a Kylie record. It's the new piece's names. And what he does so well is that he manages to create arguments that I think are quite divisive. He's a lot of archive material. It's very highly stylized. He's able to sort of draw relationships with politics and the economy and culture and power and influence to create an argument. And I think it's one of those pieces of work that really makes me frustrated. Like you sometimes don't, you either fall under his spell and you can completely agree with everything he's saying, or you're completely against. But regardless of what side you're on, you can't help being captivated. It's like you like being involved in that argument. Sometimes I wish that with his work, it comes with an accompaniment. Here's some people arguing to and for whether they actually agree with him, rather than just leaving the work as is. But I still find it compelling. And the fact that the BBC still has him and he's not been snapped up elsewhere is quite a feat, I think. So that starts, I think, just before Valentine's Day. And I'm sure at odds with the themes that he'll be encompassing, it will be quite opposite to the joy that Valentine's Day likes to bring.
Watch Can't Get You Out of My Head, An Emotional History of the Modern World, but new from Adam Curtis, with your loved one on February the 14th, and have an argument. I love Adam Curtis's stuff, actually. I love how subjective it is, how it's kind of one guy saying this is how it is, and it's up to you at home, I suppose, to agree or disagree. But it's always powerful stuff, and as you say, Scott, just his use of archive material, his use of music, it's kind of always a dizzying, kind of hypnotic, intoxicating thing. So, well, I'm really looking forward to that. It says, just reading a little bit of the press release, a new 6-film series traces different forces across the world that have led to now, not just in the West, but in China and Russia as well, covers modern conspiracy theories, opium and opioids, AI, melancholy over loss of empire, love and power. Now, if that hasn't got Valentine's Day argument written all over it, I don't know what has.
But also, it's so vague as well. I mean, those are really wide things, you know. And,
yeah.
And I think that's why I was sort of saying that, like, it's hard to know exactly what the heart of his work is about, because he likes to encompass such broad topics.
Yeah.
And then tries to, you know, create an argument from it.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting stuff. That premieres on the BBC on the 11th of February. We promised also that we'd cover some old stuff, Scott. Well, I'm going to let you do the reveal on what is coming to Disney Plus on the 19th of February worldwide.
I mean, I could try to sing the theme tune, but I'm worried that everyone would immediately switch off. So I'm not going to. But, you know, it's time to face the music. It's time to light the lights. The Muppet Show, all the original classic episodes are dropping on the streaming platform. And I think it's really interesting because until now, I just don't think you've really had the chance to watch this classic show. I think so many millions of us in the UK and in the US watch this show because of the A-level talent that used to completely be it on it. The stars on it, phenomenal. You know, Vincent Price, Diana Ross, Elton John, Roger Moore, Mark Hamill. It was a show I feel that millions of us watched in our youth but didn't really understand because a lot of it was adult humour and kind of went over our heads. But it also had this sense of unpredictability about it. The Muppets, I think, back then were, I think, less cutesy back then. They were a bit more risque, a bit less Disney-fied. And I think that they've tried to recreate this in the modern form. There was one where they tried to make digital shorts that reflected our social media use and tried to be, you know, reflecting Instagram culture, and it kind of felt a bit flat on its face because it was a bit try too hard. But the original Muppet Show was incredibly ridiculous and unpredictable. So I think the chance for everyone to watch a show that is a kids show, I know, but just for a chance to see it again, I think is something that people are going to be looking forward to. There's a big reaction actually when they released it, when they released the news of it just last week.
There is definitely now a reason to get Disney Plus, right? I mean, it's there are so many good moments in that series. I absolutely adore The Muppet Show. That would be amazing. Thank you, Scott. That is that's The Muppet Show. It's coming to Disney Plus on the 19th of February. And we're going to squeak in with your other recommendation. You've been addicted to The West Wing.
I have been. It's now finally got a place where you can watch the classic American drama that looked at a fictional administration. Very hopeful, very different to what we've seen in the US political system over the last 4 years, at least. And I'm currently now in season two, you know, written by Aaron Sorkin for the first four seasons. So you'd have to savour them because after the fourth season, it kind of dips a bit. But it's still a phenomenal piece of work. And I absolutely love it. So it's on All Four, which is not awful. It's just the name of the service, All Four. Still to this day, don't know why I understand why that was what the name they chose, but sure. And all of the episodes are available there. And I think it's available on different streamers around the world, but at least finally you're able to watch it in the UK.
Okay, a lot of walking and talking. Perhaps the original show where walking and talking was done. Aaron Sorkin's The West Wing. Scott, thank you. What a wealth of wonderful stuff. There's absolutely no way I'm leaving the sofa for the month of February. Thank you.
Well, you can't, so.
All right.
We all can't, not specifically
don't rub
you.
It in.
PC Brian there. You've got to stay in Dorset.
I've got my clipboard.
That was TV with Scott Brian. Georgie, it's your turn to wow us with some of your wonderful choices. We're going first to Bicep, an excellently named band. Tell us a little about these guys.
Yeah, so they're a DJ production duo from Belfast, Northern Ireland, now based in London, childhood friends. For a long time, they sort of made their name with the Feel My Bicep blog, which was a kind of blog of Italo and house, disco deep cuts that basically, I mean, they had a crazy amount of hits on that. And then that led to them releasing their own tune. So for a while, they kind of did a club night, released loads of stuff. And then in 2017, we had their first proper studio album, released on Ninja Tune, self-titled, and it was just a trip. It was like throwback rave sounds with a really contemporary production, really psychedelic, layered. It kind of crossed over and made the top 20 UK album chart here in the UK and spawned, you know, loads of big tunes. People raved about it, people raved to it, and they just played all these kind of monster shows off the back of it. They did a four-night residency at Printworks, big production, and now they're back, and this is their second record. I've had the stream for 2 months, so I've gone deep with it already at this point, and it hasn't even come out yet.
Well, let's have a clip. So the album is called Isles. It's by Bicep, as Georgie says, and this is Apricots. I love the sound of that. That's got a lot of different kind of things going on in it. I've got a quote here from Matt McBriar of Bicep, who says this is the home listening version. Does it feel like that to you, or does it feel like you want to be out in a field, or you want to be down the front, a kind of like sweaty venue with this?
It absolutely gives you that I want to go out listening to this record. Like, I've had the, you know, watermarked up to its eyeballs stream, and I've put my web browser on, put the stream, and then when I've gone for a run in lockdown, I just had it on, because it's just such a sort of expansive sound. And what they will do is they'll beef this up when they go and play those big shows again, and when they can tour. This will be like all-encompassing, ravey, just full of whoppers, kind of beefed up sound. But the record still gives you that kind of hit. I don't know quite what happens to the serotonin levels, but Bicep somehow managed to kind of tap into them and give you a little boost with every record. But they're kind of painting, I think, with quite a broad palette of kind of sounds here. And now they're based in East London, which is a very multicultural area of London, and they said that they, you know, gathered a lot of sounds from London, so Hindi vocals that they heard over rooftops, and Bulgarian choirs out of taxis, and Turkish pop in kebab houses and things. And it sort of encapsulates a kind of a city feel. And there's a track on the record called Sundial, which is the next single that they've just released in the last few days, and I think it's kind of one of the best moments on the record. But it's got this vocal sample that they used from Jab Antira Hota Hai, which is from a 1973 Bollywood film, Raja Rani. And it's just got this kind of beautiful, sort of almost melancholy sound over beats which they made from a faulty Jupiter Art recording.
Oh, a classic. Sample, yeah.
But the trigger wasn't working properly and the ARP notes were skipping, and they kind of used that and then built a song around it. It kind of just shows how sometimes that there's perfection in imperfection, you know. But yeah, it's very kind of nostalgic for the 90s rave scene, but there's choral elements and two-step and UK garage and kind of percussive beats and a lot of warmth to it. It's quite sort of bittersweet club music. So it's sort of, crying on the dance floor as much as sort of escaping and feeling that sense of euphoria. I think it's coming at a point where people need this, you know, because we can't go out at the moment. We're all absolutely desperate to be in a field at a festival in the summer, you know. This will take you there, even if we can't be there physically for a while.
It's so weird, isn't it, in which we've had, you know, now a year's worth of music, but no festival to enjoy it, if that makes sense. Like, so many songs and so many anthems that you hear all the time that you realise that you've never danced with other people to, that you've only heard it in your own house or going out on a run. Like you were saying, you get much more immersed in it when it's actually performing live.
Yeah. When I'm at a festival or in a big venue watching them play next, I'll be the one at the front just weeping. I will be like, I feel emotional just even at the idea of that, you know.
And for anyone that doesn't live downwind of Georgie Rogers' sitting room hi-fi, Biceps Isles is out on the 22nd of January. Thanks, Georgie. Your next choice is new from Goat Girl. The album is called On All Fours. Let's get into it. This is a clip of Baddie Baba. Baddie, baddie, baddie. Okay, that was Goat Girl, clip of Baddie Baba from the new album On All Fours. Tell us about these girls, Georgie.
Yeah, so they formed about 5 years ago, four Londoners convened in and around Southeast London, and the Brixton Windmill, classic venue, was sort of a hub for their creativity. They met the bassist. There was a new bassist for the second record. They met her there and wrote her some material and used to play shows and things. And they put out a brilliant debut. Rough Trade came on board early doors, and it was quite a defiant sound, quite, you know, conscious lyrically, with a twang of kind of country and with the post-punk, but a strong debut. And now this is their second record, On All Fours. And I think, as with any album going from first to second, if the second album's done well and things haven't just fallen apart completely, you hear the sound of a band maturing into the second album. You know, they know the deal. They've done it once before. They know how it all works. And if anything, there's kind of just more confidence and they know who they are and they can kind of be a bit more experimental perhaps. And I think that's what's happening with this. They've definitely entered a different territory in terms of synths. It's laden with just like glorious synths and layered harmonies, a really live band feel, built from home demos, phone recordings, and they said relentless jamming. So they've obviously just kind of found their click and just tried lots of different ideas out. And I think that sense of kind of togetherness can be heard. You know, it really hangs really well, and it's maybe makes sense that they worked with Dan Carey on this. So Dan Carey's a producer. He's sort of done a lot. So he did all the Kate Tempest work and Fontaine CC, Nadine Shah. He works with really interesting artists. And I've heard that he just has all this kit and he's just one of those producers that kind of no idea is crazy, you know, just really find your thing and experiment. And for this record, I was reading that he'd suggested that the band borrow his MPC drum machine and his Streatham studio to just go and practice playing with pre-programmed beats. So there's this kind of layering of the beats element with the live band feel and live band sound, and it just comes together in a really lovely fusion.
It sounds amazing, and I love that. There was a bit of from the clip we heard there as well, just there's kind of something like post-punk meets like surf pop as well. There's something really lovely about the kind of about the layering of the harmonies and all the rest of it as well. And also I guess if Dan Carey's been working with Kate Tempest, Nadine Shah, really lyrically, obviously one being a poet as well, such lyrically sharp songwriters as well. And that sounds like it's coming to the fore with Goat Girl.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I love their track titles. We've got PTST, as in tea, cup of tea, Pest, Bang, and then Jazz, in brackets, in the supermarket. I mean, I want to listen to this record.
I want to listen to that. Sounds great.
And then Sad Cowboy is also just, there's just worth mentioning, that's, I feel, is going to be a real moment on the record. You can hear that they've put that out as one of the first singles, but it's just got this synth section that kind of makes you want to swing through the saloon doors straight to the dance floor. And it's kind of a Todd Terrier, Lindstrom, you know, sort of evocative of those kind of Scandinavian producers who just get in this hypnotic rhythm and this sort of progressive techno sound underpinning it. I'm excited. I feel like I just think they're a really exciting band around at the moment, and I'm really excited for I want to see them live.
I was going to say that's two bands already that we just can't wait to be down the front of somewhere at some point. That is on All Fours. That is a new album from Goat Girl. It's out on the 29th of January. And one of the things that went into it, according to Georgie Rogers, was, and I quote, relentless jamming. Okay, so your next choice is Madlib, and Sound Ancestors is the name of their new album. We're gonna have a clip of Hop Rock. So we had a little clip there of Hop Rock from the new album Sound Ancestors from Madlib, with which I'm unfamiliar, actually. Georgie, tell us about Madlib a little bit.
Okay, so Madlib is an American DJ producer and MC, but he is a big deal when it comes to hip hop and alternative hip hop. He's basically one of the most acclaimed hip hop producers of all time. So we talk about records that he did with Jay Dilla, Freddie Gibbs. In 2004, he put out Mad Villainy, which was an album with MF Doom, and it's just hailed as a classic hip hop album. And we've been talking about that recently because MF Doom's death was announced on New Year's Eve. So he's been working on stuff. He did a bit of production for Kanye West. And then over his career, he's also worked under pseudonyms in a more kind of jazz-based space or electronic projects, or done soundtrack work. He soundtracked a Tribe Called Quest documentary. And this is him working on a new solo album with Fortet, which I mean, this is kind of the sort of music that I'm obsessed with. And Forte is, you know, one of the most revered electronic producers around of the last 20 years, really. And so they've been longtime friends. And Forte, he's kind of a master of sound design, and so he uses a lot of samples in his work. As it turns out, as I understand it, Kieran was listening to Madlib's demos across all sorts of styles and felt that it could kind of be arranged as an album, as a complete body of work. So they had some food, some dinner, and over dinner he suggested that he try and work this into something. And then Madlib started sending tracks, loads and hundreds of loops, ideas, experiments. And then Kieran, over the course of about 2 years, would kind of arrange and edit and manipulate and fit it all together. And it's just, it's a tantalising combo.
I like that. I like the idea of them coming together over who knows what they're having for supper. But I love Kieran Hebden's stuff. I love Fortet. It's got such a sort of density to it. That's Madlib collaborating with Fortet, and the album is called Sound Ancestors. As Georgie says, it's out on the 29th of January. And we're going to finish up as Scott got to choose the Muppets and West Wing. We've got we're dusting off a classic, Georgie. What have you got for us today?
I mean, I don't know if I've really put myself across as a very happy person today.
It doesn't have to be like the Muppets.
All the stuff I've been watching and listening to is really dark.
Crying at the disco.
Yeah, I think I'm just such a creature of habit. When I sort of want to be comforted and soothed, I've picked an album that is absolutely riddled with anxiety, but we've been listening to Radiohead's OK Not OK a lot in the house, which is the 2017 reissue of OK Computer, which Radiohead put out 20 years ago. And then there's a third disc of B-sides and bonus material. It's not the cheeriest. I think people are very divided on Radiohead. You're either an obsessive fan, like I am. The first time I discovered this record, OK Computer, in my brother's record collection when I was about 15, just a few years after it had come out, I was obsessed with it then, and I'm as obsessed with this band now. And I just it's comfort. I just go back and listen to all their records. And we talk about seminal albums, but I must have listened to OK Computer probably 1,000 times in my lifetime. And how is it that I don't ever tire of it? I find new things in it all the time. It's just, and it's just quite apps, I think, for now, like the digital age prophecy and how we're being controlled by our phones and the internet and like climbing up the walls, just stuck in doors and yeah,
it's amazing.
I love
it. Pull me out of the air crash.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But there's some beautiful tracks on the extra disc. There's Lift, Man of War, I Promise, stuff from around that time that you can understand why it maybe didn't make the cut, but it's still like great songs in their own right. But I got bought it on vinyl. It sort of came full circle. My brother bought it for me for my birthday in November on vinyl, the whole kind of release. So having poached his CD aged 16, I've now got the vinyl. We've just been listening to it, and we'll just sit there working and then be like, I'm on a roll, you know, just like singing along, pull me out of the air crash.
Oh man.
Oh, it's like therapy.
Of some sort. Thank you, Georgie, for your wonderful choices. We finished up with Radiohead's OK Not OK and At Roger's Mansions. That is the vinyl reissue, no less. That originally came out on the 23rd of June 2017. Thank you both so much. That is all we have time for today. Thank you to my guests, Georgie Rogers and Scott Bryan. Monocle on Culture was, of course, produced by Holly Fisher and researched by Madeline Pollard. We'll be back at the same time next week, so do join us then. But until then, from me, Robert Bounds, thank you very much for tuning in.